From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. How much do you really know about the Civil War?
22% of white Southern men of military age died. But if we're to be historically accurate and intellectually honest, we must simultaneously talk about the 4 million black Southerners, 42% of the South's entire population, who were freed because of Confederate defeat.
That's Atlanta History Center President Sheffield Hale. We talk today about whether Confederate monuments are about history or something else. But first, last week we went to Macon for the break room and we talked about corporal punishment in public schools.
I have a board of education for my grandchildren, and I have used it. And I would recommend everybody going down to Michael's and picking up one. It's amazing what just the sight of it will do to adjust behavior.
No. It's a terrible idea. I would have pulled my child. I taught high school in Mississippi. We paddled students. I did not. It did not improve behavior at all. It only increased divisiveness.
That's Anya Silver, poet and professor of English at Mercer. And you also heard Charles Richardson, opinion page editor for the Macon Telegraph. Here are your first thoughts. Joel Cook tweets, "If a teacher paddled my kid, I would paddle their face. Children are people. I can't paddle my employees because it's assault." Kalina Michelle says, "I was paddled in kindergarten, but it was a private Christian school. That kind of discipline should stay out of public schools." We love getting your opinion on things like that, so share your thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message, or find us on Twitter and Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. 50,000 Fulton County voters got letters saying they may be declared inactive. They did not update the address on their voter registration cards. The Georgia ACLU is threatening legal action against the state, claiming it's in violation of the Voter Registration Act of 1993. So what is really going on here? Joining us to sort it out is Andra Gillespie, Emory University political science professor. Hi, Andra.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Part of the reason this is so fraught at this moment is because alleged voter suppression, and voter registration is included in that, is a big part of political strategy. Has that always been the case?
Well, it's not unusual to hear about a voter purge, and a purge in and of itself is not necessarily illegal. It is periodic that states, and this happens all over the country, will reach out to voters who haven't voted in a long period of time to verify that they're still there. They want to be sure that they haven't moved, and they want to be sure that they haven't died.
It's just part of updating records.
Of updating records, and when they don't hear back from you, then you get put on the inactive list. It doesn't mean you can't vote, but they are flagging you to see whether or not you vote in another allotted period of time. And then if you don't vote within that allotted period of time, some states will actually just pull you off of the rolls entirely, assuming that you either don't live there anymore or that you're deceased.
We have a statement here from the state. Excuse me. This is from Candace Brose, press secretary, the Georgia Secretary of State's office. They say, quote, "Under federal and state law, we are required to conduct regular maintenance of Georgia's voter rolls. It ensures our records are accurate and works to preserve the integrity of our electoral system. This is not the first time our processes have been challenged, and I doubt that it will be the last. Nonetheless, it's our duty to keep the voter rolls up to date, and we will vigorously defend this duty in the face of opposition." So why would this ever be even seen as some kind of voter suppression?
So here are the questions that need to be asked, I think, for any type of voter purge. Is it being done uniformly across a particular jurisdiction?
Right. Why is it focused on Fulton County?
Yeah. Is it being done, you know, if it's being done uniformly, does it look like a particular population is being targeted as a result of this purge? So if there are things that look like certain people are being disproportionately subject to purging and being declared inactive, then those are the types of things that would raise a red flag that would then cause people to want to ask questions and to want to litigate.
So as I mentioned, the ACLU has said they may file suit. We have a statement from the ACLU of Georgia, which says, quote, "This is a textbook case of modern-day voter suppression, and it needs to stop. Instead of simply updating Stacy's address, as the law requires," Stacy is one of the people included in this potential suit, "Georgia officials sent her a threatening notice saying her voter registration was at risk. This bureaucratic red tape falls hardest on low-income families and people of color, making it harder for them to vote just months before important municipal elections." They're talking about the language here that the state used, and you're nodding your head. Why is the language the state used in their notice at issue here?
Well, I mean, I think the issue here is how people will, how a reasonable person would interpret that. So if I got that as somebody who studies this stuff, as somebody who has witnessed and has done research on, you know, purge voter rolls, it wouldn't be something that's shocking to me. I understand that it is not something that's particularly alarming. But imagine that this is your first interaction kind of with the state post-voter registration, and you get language that almost tells you, like, you can't vote anymore, even though that's not what they're telling you. Exactly. It could have a chilling effect on your likelihood to turn out to vote. It may make you think that you're in trouble. You may not necessarily go follow up to, you know, register your address or to make sure that you stay on the voter rolls. So so for those who are advocates of voting rights and who are anti-voter suppression, they want to make sure that in every aspect of the process, from how easy the process is to how often you have the ability to be able to vote, to the language that one uses when you're doing maintenance, that it's all being done in a way to help the constituent, to help the client sort of feel, you know, as empowered and to make the process as easy for them as possible.
And I should mention, since we talked about demographics a little, that Fulton County, not surprisingly, is almost evenly split between white and black. There's also other races there, Asian, tiny portion of Indian, American Indian, and Hispanic and Latino as well. But mostly we're talking a very high concentration of African Americans, which I assume is part of the reason people are suspicious of the effort. But there's no indication at this point that it's because of the demographics that caused the state to send out these notices?
So, I mean, so I think that's the question that I think is going to have to be raised as sort of people decide how to proceed with this. So if it looks like all of the people who got this notice were in East Point, for instance, and that there are people who were in a similar situation who hadn't voted for a long period of time in Alpharetta or Sandy Springs or Johns Creek who weren't getting the same type of notices, that's a huge red flag. But if a person in Alpharetta and a person in East Point have an equal probability of getting this notice, and in fact, just given the fact that it's a county, everybody who hadn't voted in a few years is getting this notice, then I think it's going to be a harder case to make that there's something discriminatory going on.
For those listening, Alpharetta is predominantly white. East Point is predominantly black. That's why we're mentioning those. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. At this point, how likely is it that any attempt to purge the voter rolls, which, as you say, is relatively normal, is going to be seen as some kind of voter suppression?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if voting rights advocates look at any type of purge as being suspicious. But it is part of the normal process. It's part of sort of the normal maintenance that goes into what's going on. So I think just voters need to be educated about the fact that registering to vote is one thing, but your vote is public record, and people do pay attention to whether or not you actually vote in elections. And so if you go long periods of time and you don't vote in, you know, congressional elections and presidential elections for a long period of time or anything in between, people then start to wonder whether or not you actually still live at that address. So it's important to make sure that once you register, that you do in fact turn out to vote, and that you turn out regularly and you keep your records up to date.
Here's a comment from Atlanta NAACP President Richard Rose. He was speaking to Channel 2 about the voter ID lawsuit. This is a separate one filed against Georgia's Secretary of State during the 2016 election.
And this is just another trick, another way to limit people. And so this is just a new wrinkle that the Secretary of State unfortunately has adopted to try to continue to suppress voting rights.
And I want to play one more comment from you. Earlier this year in Hancock County, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights filed suit against the county. That's Hancock County. It summoned black voters to verify their identity. So here's Roland Martin on TV1 reporting about that in May.
Dozens of black voters in Georgia will get their voting rights back after they were snatched from the voting rolls. The move concludes a dispute between Hancock County and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. County officials sent sheriff's deputies to summon black voters to appear before them and prove they lived in the county. Because of the action, it said the board deemed ineligible more than 5% of the city's 988 registered voters. The Lawyers Committee said the methods violated the law, and now the county has agreed to a settlement.
How crippled are watchdog groups like the ACLU or the Lawyers Committee at this point because of the changes that the Supreme Court made in the Voting Rights Act?
Well, actually, they're not, because those would fall under separate sections of the Voting Rights Act. So, you know, what we can't do based on Shelby County versus Holder anymore is have states who were under the Voting Rights Act
including
have to do
Georgia,
having to do preclearance. So anytime that they, you know, move a voting precinct from, you know, one school to another school, or anytime they drew district lines, they had to get it approved by the Justice Department before it would go into effect. So that, you know, that part has been enjoined by the Supreme Court decision until Congress rewrites the Voting Rights Act to define who falls under preclearance, because that's the issue, was the definition of who fell under preclearance was deemed old and outdated. If you look at John Roberts' opinion, you still, Section 2 is still fully in effect. So you can't do things to try to deny people their voting rights that, you know, on their face look like they're racially, religiously or national origins motivated. So if these things are still happening, then you can still bring Section 2 claims against, you know, against counties, against municipalities for things that they're doing. And so, you know, I'm not familiar with the Hancock County case, but if they're, you know, are asking blacks to come in,
they were,
and they're not asking whites to go in, that's problematic. And then also the fact that you're asking people to kind of come in and of itself, I think strikes people as shocking. One of the things that, you know, I learned as a result of some work that a student of mine, Madeline Brown, was doing for her senior thesis this past year, was that in Georgia, if you think that somebody is voting illegally, so for instance, you think that there's an abandoned apartment building where there are people who are registered to vote, but yet they're still turning out to vote at this address that's clearly not occupied, citizens themselves can actually bring, can actually challenge the voting rights of people. And so that's an interesting thing to know, that sometimes citizens use this against each other as a means of being able to, you know, try to, you know, deny people their voting rights. And sometimes, you know, if you think it's because of actual voting fraud, you know, that may be legitimate, but this may be something as a policy standpoint we may want to reconsider about whether or not people use this against each other or have the opportunity to use it against each other.
The bottom line is that if the state is doing a routine purging of voter rolls to make sure that their records are up to date and that it's equitable, it's not targeted at any one demographic or political party, then there's nothing to be concerned about here.
Right.
Move along.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there may be people who don't like the idea of a purge in and of itself, but they're within their right to do it.
On the other hand, there have been times in American political history when purges have been used to knock a bunch of certain party voters off voter rolls, right?
So what I would say is that what you need to look at is whether or not there looks like a group is being disproportionately targeted. And so if it looks like a group is being disproportionately targeted, then I think you need to question the motivations behind that, and then litigation would be appropriate.
But your advice to voters themselves is A, keep your address updated, but also vote.
Keep your address updated, for sure. Make sure you vote, because you don't have to worry about being declared inactive if you regularly go vote. And then if you do get challenged and somebody does try to deny your right to vote, you have the right to demand a provisional ballot, and then you can get it straight the next day. So under any circumstances, if anybody ever denies you the right to vote, demand the provisional ballot on the spot. And then the next day, if you need to go take an ID someplace or you need to demonstrate your residency someplace else, you can handle that the day after the election.
Okay, good advice from Andra Gillespie, as always. She is political science professor at Emory University. Andra, you're going to stick around. We still have more to talk about. New study says people who fly the Confederate battle flag often know very little about Confederate history. But first, Andra sticks around to talk about why congressional incumbents get reelected and reelected and reelected and reelected. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. In the 2016 election cycle, the Georgia House had the highest rate of uncontested seats of any state house in the nation. Of 180 House seats, only 31 featured candidates from both parties. The uncontested seats amounted to roughly 83%. Here to talk about this is Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Andra Gillespie, still with us, political science professor at Emory University. Hello again.
Hello.
Okay, so Greg, why don't many of these seats have... Why don't the parties even try to field a candidate?
Yeah, it's a strange but familiar paradox. I mean, at the same time, there's this anti-incumbent wave. It seems like every cycle... The vast majority of incumbents get reelected, even if they have stunning problems like some of our incumbents did.
Well, let me mention one of those. Here is Georgia. Here's Representative Tommy Benton, who faced a great deal of criticism for publicly defending the KKK.
And I understand that African Americans, for the most part, have a problem with the slavery issue. But they don't denounce their ancestors that were in Africa that were selling slaves. They find it offensive because they have not been taught a true history of the war.
Okay, we're not going to go into that. I can see Andra...
wants to.
Yes. But this is one of those people, I think it's fair to say, a troubling history, still reelected.
Mm-hmm. And there was incumbents with arrests. There's incumbents with lawsuits, damaging lawsuits against them. There's all sorts of, you know... red flags at some incumbents, and yet they all were elected. Well, most of the incumbents were elected with sizable majorities. It speaks about the burden, the high barrier of entry, I think is the right way to say it, to running for election. It costs.
Are you talking about money?
Yeah, it costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time, especially if you're outside of Metro Atlanta. It means risking your personal business. It means taking a toll on your family life. I helped moderate a panel the other day of young lawmakers, and there was a lot of wannabe candidates in the room, and it ended up being a long discussion from those young lawmakers about the toll that running for office takes on their life. And these were mostly Metro Atlanta politicians, but it's not just a 40-day legislative session anymore. It's an almost year-round affair, and if you don't have employment that in a boss or a personal business that where you can take
walk
the time
away,
off you need,
yeah.
It's really hard to do it these days. And these races are so expensive now.
Well, Andra, to what extent, let's hear a little clip of John Oliver giving a theory. His is his theory about why some legislators mm-hmm. keep their seats.
State houses do a huge amount of work while no one is watching, from abortion to gun control to environmental legislation. And yet, admit it, you probably don't know who your state legislator is, which means all those conspiracy theories about a shadow government are actually true.
Okay, so to what extent is this just a reflection of how ill-informed, uninformed we all are on our state government and how little we value that?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably a combination of all of those things. So when we think about, in general, why incumbency advantage works, there are a lot of things. So some of the more obvious reasons are because somebody has high name recognition, people will see their name on a ballot, and if that's the one that they know, like even if they don't know much about that person, they know, I actually have heard of this person before where I haven't heard of the other candidates on the ballot. So that's going to give them an advantage. There's certainly an advantage with incumbency that allows people to have access to greater fundraising networks and other types of things. But the other thing that people talk about in political science is this notion of people vote what they know. And so even if what they know is bad, you are voting what you know versus the unknown. So people can make all kinds of empty promises that aren't based in any type of experience base. So especially if you have a candidate who hasn't held office before, making promises about all of the things that they're going to do running up against an experienced candidate, you may not like everything about the experienced incumbent, but they at least have a track record. And so the track record is safer than the unknown.
That's exactly the opposite of what happened in the presidential election.
Well,
right?
No, I mean, so in this particular case, while they're both very known commodities, and while Hillary Clinton had experience, neither of them had experience being president. So, you know, if it had been Donald Trump versus Barack Obama, Barack Obama's incumbency advantage may have helped him to some degree. I mean, there's a racial element that we wouldn't talk about, but this is all kind of counterfactual there. But it's the reason why most good candidates wait for an open seat. They don't like to run against incumbents.
Okay, so let's talk about redistricting and how that plays into this. Here's Roland Martin, a commentator on News One Now at this point. He's explaining a controversial measure from the last session of the legislature here in Georgia that might help explain what we're talking about.
Speaking of elections in Georgia, Republican majority state Senate is set to vote on a bill passed by the House that would redraw 9 of their districts in an effort to protect their majority. The changes would reduce the number of people of color in districts where these Democratic leaning voters have threatened to oust Republican incumbents.
Now, Greg, your reporting today seems to suggest that maybe Republican Alan Peake agrees with this to a certain extent. He suggests in the article that you posted that uncontested seats and the redistricting actually leads to greater polarization.
Yeah, if you know you're in a safe seat, if you know you have no real challenge out there, then what's the incentive for working across party lines? That's his point. And that's a broader point that's being made all over the nation with groups that are trying to push for more nonpartisan levels of redistricting. And yet those efforts languish. And there's a group that just earlier this year, a bipartisan group, mostly Democrats, but Josh McCune, Republican senator, was also part of that coalition, that pushed for a citizens commission to help redraw the district lines. And it went nowhere. It didn't even get a vote.
So one of the things that I'll point out is that when we try to identify the cause of polarization in the United States, there's a lot of contestation, you know, amongst political scientists about what causes polarization. So the argument in favor of districting causing polarization is based on newer data that is still being vetted, and people are still kind of arguing about it. The older literature, which has been published, suggests that it's really not districting that's the issue, that it's more our own ideological polarization. So in fact, American citizens themselves are becoming more polarized. And so you don't have as many liberal Republicans or conservative Democrats anymore being a moderating force within their own party. So if people are going to, you know, the camps are becoming more extreme and therefore are disincentivized from working with one another.
So Todd Rehm has some comments for you, Greg. He says, first, he tweets, "My dad lives in Representative Benton's district. No one there has heard the Atlanta-based criticism of him." That's point number one. And number two, Todd asks, if it's about the cost of running, why so many Democratic candidates in 7, which takes millions, and none for the Gwinnett Commission?
That's a good point. But you are seeing right now already there, Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor, of course, she represents an in-town Atlanta district. There are already 3 candidates running for that seat, and they've raised, I think, more than $150,000 between the 3 of them. It might be close to $200,000. That talks about the cost of running for even an open seat that's a safe Democratic seat. If you look at the 180 state House seats that are up for grabs next year, there might be 10 to 15 that are going to be truly competitive. And that might be a stretch, even saying 10 to 15 are truly competitive. There's a handful of districts that are held by Republicans that Hillary Clinton won in November. Those are the ones that Democrats will have an eye on. But still, it speaks to the vast majority of these House districts and Senate districts, state Senate districts too, are just not competitive at all between the two parties.
So if I could, hey, Todd, by the way,
hey,
if I could respond to that, I mean, part of this issue is party building and capacity. So where you have in general elections people running unopposed, that suggests that the other party might not have the capacity or needs to build capacity to be able to mount strong challengers so that these districts—
They don't have the capacity to create capacity.
So, I mean, if you're not contesting seats, then what that suggests is that there's some party building that needs to happen so that you are cultivating strong candidates to run. Because even in some of these, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic and overwhelmingly Republican districts, there is a minority, and it's actually in some ways probably sizable minority of people who represent the other point of view who would actually at least want to have a contest about what's going on. Now, most candidates would look at that, and if you know the district is 70-30 and you represent the 30%, you're not going to waste your time because you don't want to cultivate a reputation of being kind of the crackpot candidate who always runs and never wins for office. So that actually keeps candidates out of it. But if the parties were developing in the places where they were uncompetitive so that you would have more competitive races, that would be fine. But I think the other issue, the Tommy Benton issue, is what happens, you know, internally within Republican Party politics in his district. So is there somebody who's willing to run and challenge them? And I think the thing that we're worried about in this day and age is not necessarily being challenged by the center. It's being challenged by somebody who's actually more extreme.
Todd Rehm is still tweeting. I won't read them all, but it's clear he wanted to be part of this discussion. But Greg Bluestein, to what extent is this just a function of the fact that people are just voting on party lines? I mean, in that case, it doesn't have anything to do necessarily with redistricting or money or anything else, just that if you're a member of the Republican Party, you're going to vote for whomever the Republican is.
Yeah, and that's the key point of this next cycle. Andra spoke about it. The biggest challenges these candidates often face is from their own party, their own flanks.
Yeah.
That was the big question that dominated the 2016 elections, whether or not Republicans who voted in favor of the transportation tax increases would end up getting punished for it. They didn't. And many of them faced primary challengers who tried to exploit that fact. But still, there will be the same thing in 2018. There'll be challengers from within their own parties who will try to pounce on candidates for their votes rather than candidates from opposing parties who try to do the same thing.
We have about 30 seconds, Andra. You want to tell us what might change this?
So, since we're still arguing in academic circles about whether it's ideological polarization or districting, I think we need to separate the empirics from the normative issue. And I think we need to ask ourselves an ethical question. Should we allow partisans and elected officials to draw their own district lines? Something is really problematic about that just from a theoretical standpoint. So can we do nonpartisan districting?
That's Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University, and Greg Bluestein is reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We hope you heard our broadcast from the historic Douglas Theater last week. We celebrated Macon's musical talent and paid tribute to its history with a live audience.
The Douglas Theater is a place that is history. The Douglas Theater had what they call the Saturday morning teenage show, for instance. Imagine having Otis Redding, Little Richard, Ray Charles, James Brown, all competing against each other as teenagers on this talent show. Can you imagine that?
That's Johnny Hollingshed Jr., a fixture of the Macon music scene and the host of weekly jam sessions at Grant's Lounge downtown. Macon has a history of fostering talent. For 10 years now, the Otis Redding Foundation has hosted a summer camp to connect talented young people with coaches from the music industry. We talked about this with Foundation Director Carla Redding Andrews.
Most importantly, what we want to do is instill confidence in these kids.
And some of the kids from the Otis Music Camp performed for our live audience at the Douglas Theater. Here's a bit of Lee McCombs and Sarah Haseen performing their original song, The Chase. That's 15-year-old Lee McCombs and 16-year-old Sarah Haseen. We also heard 17-year-old singer-songwriter Chance Moorman. Makenite Chance Moorman with her original song, Thunderstorm. Finally, here's brother and sister duo Eris and Artist Johnston with their rendition of At Last and What a Wonderful World.
She had.
Eris Johnston singing with her brother Artis Johnston in front of a live audience at the Douglas Theater in Macon last week. You can see video of that performance and check out pictures of our night online at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, can you name two Civil War battles? If so, you're probably a lot less likely to wave a Confederate flag. This is On Second Thought.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and for you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day and the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, yeah, what a wonderful world.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends
again. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk about the rise of women in leading roles in the movies. It's the year of Wonder Woman, of course, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, and many more. So, what are your favorite female-led movies and TV shows? Call and leave a message at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion, and then join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. A few months ago, after a lot of debate, New Orleans removed a statue of Robert E. Lee. But when you travel across Georgia, you'll see many other Confederate monuments still standing proudly. Supporters often say those monuments are about history, but a new study raises questions about that. The study analyzed 2004 data from Georgia State University. Researcher Spencer Piston of Boston University helped review that data and found many people who support the display of Confederate flags lack basic knowledge of the Civil War. For example, via Skype, Piston told us most of the people surveyed could not name a single Civil War battle or identify Union General William Tecumseh Sherman.
White people who are more knowledgeable about the Civil War are less supportive on average of Confederate symbols, such as the Confederate battle emblem. We did not expect to find that. We thought it might be the case that there's something to this sort of pride in the history of the South.
That study raises a larger question about the role of historians in explaining the Civil War. For that, we welcome Civil War historian Kevin Levin. He joins us from Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. And also with us is Dinah Ramey Berry. She's a professor of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, Dinah.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Dinah, what do you take away? Let me start there. What do you take away from this study that showed a surprising correlation between a lack of knowledge of Civil War history and then support for flying the Confederate battle flag?
You know, I was surprised by some parts of the study and other parts I wasn't, because we kind of had gone down this route in Texas when we were looking at the University of Texas's Confederate statues. And we had several public conversations, and in those conversations, there were a number of people that knew details about battles, but they didn't necessarily look at the larger perspective of the war and the history of the war and the outcomes of the war, which, as your quote earlier stated from the Atlanta History Center president, 4 million African Americans received their freedom as a result of the South losing the war.
And then let me go then to you, Kevin. Were you surprised, as so many people were, by the results of this?
You know, not so much. I think one thing to keep in mind is that quite often people who identify with Confederate iconography, whether it's the flag or with monuments, often tend to filter it through a sort of contemporary or modern day political agenda. So one thing to keep in mind is that the monuments themselves, the symbolism is not always about history. In fact, it might more often be about present day politics, concerns about race, things like that. So there's two things going on here, I think.
We have a tweet from Edwin Austin Hall who said, Sherman's the one who looks like the grumpy uncle of someone you once knew without remembering how. Fair enough. But Dinah, to what extent is this a failure of our educational system? Shouldn't, I mean, look, there are people who can't even remember who was fighting in the Civil War. They can't even remember North versus South. So are we simply forgetting our own history, or is it not being taught?
I think it's a couple things. One, I think that the history that has been taught in the past has been not so balanced, for lack of a better phrase. So when I, even the classes I teach, when I teach history, American history, African-American history, half my class is sitting there for the majority of the semester saying, well, we never learned this. We never were told this part of the story. We were never told this half of American history. Why don't we know about African-Americans who were forced to go to the Civil War with their Confederate enslavers? Why were we not told about that, and then them dragging them back and saving them during different battles? How come this history hasn't been included? So I think it's really a part of looking at history to include all groups and the full context of American history, so that we're not just telling one side of the story or showing this celebratory history that we often try to do when we talk about American history.
So let's play a clip of a video taken on the campus of Texas Tech University in 2014. In this, for this project, they asked students on campus questions about history and politics. So here's some of the responses when they were asked about the Civil War.
We did? The South?
Like the one in 1965? What Civil War?
Who won it?
Who was even in it?
Who was in it? Just tell me who was in it.
Ooh, I don't know.
America? I don't know.
That's the Confederates, right?
Okay, so Kevin, I don't even know where to start with this. These are not stupid students. These are many of them studying medicine at Texas Tech University, but don't know who was in the war, let alone who won it. How do we address that?
Well, I'm a little, always a little bit suspicious at these sort of, you know, these attempts to sort of, you know, these gotcha moments, you know, on the streets. And so it is disturbing on the one hand, no doubt. I do think we should take a step back and sort of acknowledge that over the last few decades, you know, we have seen a significant transformation in terms of, you know, how the Civil War is taught in the classrooms, even the high school classroom. Certainly we have a ways to go. But a lot of the myths that were taught a few decades ago, you know, you'll no longer find, at least not as many in the textbooks that we're using. We also have, of course, the internet as a resource, which is both a positive and a negative. So, you know, I think certainly, you know, we can express some concern about the interviews, but I also think that we need to acknowledge, and I think this helps explain why the monuments and the flag is so divisive right now, and that is because, you know, we have seen a shift in how Americans are willing to think about and remember this divisive moment in our history.
All right, so Dinah, to what extent is this, and you alluded to this already, but I want to go at it specifically. To what extent is this a result of the fact that there was a different telling of the history of the Civil War in the South as opposed to many places in the North? In other words, the fact that the war is still often called the War of Northern Aggression in the South, or that they have often portrayed it as not about slavery but about states' rights. Has that complicated Americans' knowledge of the facts?
I think it has. And also, I think because there are all these public symbols, when you drive across the state of Georgia or many of the southern states, you'll see monuments, you'll see historical markers that are often identifying Confederate generals or battles or different parts of that history. So I think that's part of the challenge. You don't see those same figures as often in northern states. The other challenge is just understanding the whole history and how it's taught. And I think that's what, you know, Kevin's getting at, that we're in a place where we're now starting to talk about this. This really came to a head in 2015 with the killing of the murder of the 9 African-Americans at the church in South Carolina, Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina, by Dylann Roof. And I think that's one of the catalysts that brought this conversation back up. It was in 2015 that then the state of Georgia stopped officially celebrating Confederate Memorial Day. And so I think because of that, we saw the connection between the hate that comes with some of this celebratory language and also the larger history that this comes out of.
And yet, Kevin, you say that when a community is trying to decide whether to move a monument or take a monument down, you say maybe don't ask historians about that. Why?
Well, I certainly think that historians have a role to play in explaining the historical context of these monuments. Most people don't have a firm grasp of the fact that, you know, the vast majority of Confederate monuments went up at the height of Jim Crow. So this is a point when, you know, especially African Americans certainly did not have a voice in the kinds of public discussions that, you know, that sort of shaped the commemorative landscape. In other words, what was remembered and what was not remembered. So I think historians have that role. They can play that role, and they should. But ultimately, these are, you know, discussions about the broader community, right? You know, it was the broader community that chose to erect a monument at a certain time, and it's the community that ultimately has to decide, you know, whether or not a monument is going to be relocated or removed entirely. And so, again, historians have a role to play. But I think historians are quite often tied to seeing monuments as artifacts that we want to sort of we want to maintain them so we can use them for education purposes. And I certainly have done so with my students and the public at large. But that, of course, you know, has to be placed next to the experience of having to wake up and walk by these monuments and feel as if you are not equal or that you are not welcome in your own community.
And Dinah, this actually became very clear to you. I understand that you, for a while, refrained from talking publicly about your work on the task force dealing with monuments in Texas because someone wrote in a local newspaper a threat?
Yes, yes. They threatened to chain myself and other African-American members of the task force to the Jefferson Davis statue and let us sit and let bird poop fall all over us or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote. And that was mild, and we got other threats. That's to be expected. But I also refrained from talking about it because I felt like this was a conversation that really needed to involve the context, like Kevin is saying, the historical context. And people pick the small pieces of or sound bites of the history that they want to remember and are not willing to talk about the larger history. So if I mention enslaved people or I talk about monuments for enslaved people, people will say to me, oh, well, that's a really difficult and uncomfortable part of our history. And for some people, so is the Civil War.
So then what are we to do, Kevin, going forward, especially in evaluating, you know, that Georgia still celebrates Robert E. Lee's birthday, for example. Mm-hmm. How are we to decide what to do with these monuments and what to do about our sort of glaring lack of knowledge about our own history?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't I'm not going to pretend that I have an answer because in part I don't think there really is an answer. Certainly, the shootings in Charleston in the summer of 2015, you know, functioned as the most recent catalyst for this debate, and I think it's safe to say that the last few years, I can't really think of a previous time where it's been this divisive. But you can go back to, you know, for example, the dedication of the Lee Monument in Richmond in 1890, and the editor of a black newspaper, John Mitchell, wrote very clearly. He said the black man was there to put up the monument, and at some point he will be there to tear it down. I'm sort of paraphrasing, but I'm pretty close to his words. I think these are organic discussions. I think that this is part of what it means to live in a democracy. And I think we're now at a time, you know, coming out of the civil rights movement, where people who are barred from engaging in these public discussions now have a voice through their local city councils. And I think this is actually healthy. I think it reflects sort of where we are as a nation, as a community, in terms of thinking about the Civil War. I'm actually encouraged in many ways by this discussion, although I do sort of worry about, you know, some of the more divisive, you know, elements in places like Charlottesville, where you have, you know, white supremacists marching and et cetera. And you've experienced it in Georgia as well. But overall, I think this is what needs to happen.
That is Civil War historian Kevin Levin. We also heard from Dinah Ramey Berry. She's a professor of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Georgia's Civil War legacy has been hotly debated over the years by everyone from historians to lawmakers to civil rights advocates. The Atlanta History Center developed online tools to help put Confederate monuments in historical perspective. The center's president and CEO, Sheffield Hale, explains why he thinks no Confederate memorials should be altered, removed, or moved.
The majority of Confederate monuments were erected between 1895 and 1930 during the height of Jim Crow segregation, and as such served as a way of affirming white supremacy. But for the longest time, it never occurred to me that the stone soldiers who backstopped the Southern landscape could retain any residual public power or be offensive to African Americans. To me, they were dead relics. The continuing controversy proved me wrong. African Americans always knew what the Civil War had been about, their freedom. When white Southerners like me talk about the Civil War in the South, we can't just talk about the 260,000 killed defending the Confederacy. That was indeed devastating. 22% of white Southern men of military age died. But if we're to be historically accurate and intellectually honest, we must simultaneously talk about the 4 million black Southerners, 42% of the South's entire population, who were freed because of Confederate defeat. History isn't something we just use to make ourselves feel better. If that were the case, we'd be talking about heritage, which I define as history without all the unpleasant parts. It is history, not heritage, that makes us take the next step. It asks us to question and consider the past and its issues deeply, both good and bad. I'm a committed grassroots preservationist. That means I believe the removal of historic objects from the landscape almost always serves to diminish us in our collective story. I do think it's much better that we keep these monuments. But if we keep them, we must transfer them from objects of veneration into historical artifacts that can tell the story of why they were erected and how they acted as vehicles to celebrate the Confederacy during Jim Crow. Confederate monuments are among our very last tangible links to that disturbing chapter in American history. Some suggest that the monuments should be removed to museums, parks, or cemeteries where they can be properly interpreted in a safe context. But I believe you cannot effectively place these monuments in context by taking them out of context. That does not work. It's better to provide context where these monuments have stood for decades so the public can understand the historic currents that led them to be erected, the history that has transpired over time, and the way that society and sensibilities have changed. This is, to be sure, an issue for local communities to decide for themselves based upon a full understanding of the topic. The decision to move, remove, or retain is inherently local. We're now presented with an opportunity to grapple with the underlying issues that have often divided us and continue to divide us. Rather than censoring the past, let's promote an understanding of its complexity. Let us look at these monuments from a different perspective, as artifacts that can help explain a difficult past. The past has much to teach us about who we are and where we are, if we let it.
That was Atlanta History Center President and CEO Sheffield Hale. For more on the center's online tools about Confederate monuments, visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you on this. And it's a controversial topic, so you probably have an opinion. So tell us, should Confederate monuments remain intact or moved? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.